copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
So we come to our session, our final session on this, or in this this section, Grow. This has been a four-part conversation on identifying a trajectory and taking a church from infancy to maturity, as you can see from the very graphic picture. So we've tried to raise some key issues in understanding how to grow in that direction. We focused on a big picture overview, and then the importance of a healthy church, and then yesterday the importance of doctrine. Today we come to multiplication, or increasing, or planting again. And so it's a very key element, and I've prepared a lot, but I'm going to try and compress it so that we have more time to interact. Personally, I've been involved in kind of church planting over many, many years, and I've seen lots of different styles and approaches. I'm sure you have as well. And I've come to a very significant conclusion that virtually everything works and actually nothing works. So if you came looking for the methodology that would change the life of your church and church plant, it's probably the wrong place. I don't think there's any magic universal formula. It's not that by doing this will happen. And I'm really thankful for that, because otherwise many generations and people and initiatives would be really frustrated. But at the same time, obviously, we are conscious that although God is the one who does the miraculous work of salvation, we have a lot of principles and values we need to work through. And so church multiplication is one of these essential elements. So the idea of planting and replanting and planting again and multiplying and so on. And as X29, you know, this network is part of the X29 kind of leadership leading it. So we really feel that this is an important essential value that we long to see churches that plant churches that plant churches that plant churches. And so we carry on, recur. And if you remember, our anchor verse is Acts chapter 9, verse 31. And at the end of that verse, it simply says that it multiplied. And so we want to kind of dig into that a little bit. So just a few opening remarks. Obviously, it's a very popular subject, and lots of thinking about it, lots of talking about it, lots of writing about it. And in Europe, in a particular way, I think it's the great need of the day for new churches to be planted. Living in Sicily, which is actually part of Europe, I'm more and more conscious of the fact that we really need to see more churches. And I think that's the same everywhere. And on the back of the book, Everyday Church, by Steve Timmis and Tim Chester, this is what is written. And I think it's significant because we're obviously facing a different world from maybe 50 years ago, or certainly 100 years ago. And because of that, because of the challenge, we really need to see churches multiply. We need to see churches with a vision to multiply. But the reality is, I don't know exactly what it's like where you are, and maybe your local church is an exception, but the reality is that we struggle to see that happen. Although, frankly, we talk about it and teach about it, but actually doing it is complicated. It's not a kind of, again, it's not a formula. And I was in a conversation yesterday with somebody, and we were just kind of emphasizing that it's tough. And personally, I'm involved in a new church plant, been at it for about a year and a half. We have 15 people, and it's not easy. And it's a complicated thing, and it's hard. And it really requires an extra portion of grace every day. So here what we're trying to do is we're trying to seek and to identify a clear trajectory as much as we can for church planting and growing, and maybe get a new vision for it if we don't have it, or refine it if we do. So I'm going to go through this quite quickly, this first section. It's titled A Vision for Planting, and I added again, because maybe some of you have never been involved in church planting, or maybe you're involved in church planting. And so this, in a sense, is a subject which relates to planting again. And I think it's fair to say that the whole emphasis of church in the New Testament underlines the centrality, not only of worshiping God, but also of loving your neighbor, having compassion for the community around. And no, there is no explicit single verse in scripture, go therefore as churches and plant churches that plant churches. But I think that is the theme of scripture, and it is certainly the emphasis. And we could argue a lot about disciples making churches or churches making disciples or disciples making disciples. And I don't want to get too much into that, although I think from a remark I made the other day, you know where I stand on that. And of course, if you look at Acts in particular, which again, very descriptive, you find that the missionary journeys tell of churches planted and established. So I don't think there's any doubt. I don't need to convince you. You're the choir, so we're okay with the fact that the church exists to reproduce and to plant again. However, there are obstacles to overcome, and I just very quickly want to pinpoint maybe three, and this is not an exhaustive list in any way, but again, three potential difficulties and obstacles. So certainly the first one I'd say is poor theology. And as I speak to pastors and church planters and people who are thinking of church planting and people are quite despondent sometimes in parts of Europe, I think often our church planting is hindered by poor theology. So here in Italy, often people say, oh, we've tried everything and nothing works. And that might be true. But again, if we go back to our theology and believe that God is building his church, that Jesus is building his church, then, you know, it's a bit of a wrong statement to feel that it can't be done. And or maybe sometimes because we have poor theology, we take on board a corporate mentality. So we look at Apple and McDonald's and then we try and emulate them. And that becomes yuppie church. And of course, that's not the best way forward either. So poor theology, I think, again, it could be explored further, and maybe we'll have a few minutes just to kind of look into that. The second thing, poor equipping. So obviously in Christ, we have everything. The Holy Spirit is at work in us as believers, as disciples. But at the same time, it seems very often in the practice that as churches, we're not very good at equipping the saints. So we as leaders are not very good at equipping the saints to do the work of the ministry. And part of that ministry is reaching out. And so it can be a lack of literacy and fluency in scripture. It can be the fact that sometimes we don't have a language. We've forgotten that this is 2020 and we feel we're back in the 60s or the 50s or even worse than the 19th century. And we don't take on board the fact that church planting, rather than becoming something grandiose, it also has a very simple dimension. It's about chatting the gospel. I know some people say gossiping the gospel, but I think that's a bit negative. So it's about chatting the gospel naturally. And sometimes we're not very good in equipping our believers within the churches. And then there's an issue of complacency, which can be an obstacle. And here's a great quote by the English missionary C.T. Studd. And again, it's hard work. It's not a simple thing. And so sometimes it's difficult to maintain a vision for church planting again, because it's something that it seems to be something we're good to talk about, but then actually doing it is never exactly easy. And then the final thing in this section, vision for planting, we do have resources. And so this might sound pretty obvious, but again, just let me mention a few. We have scripture, which is obviously the sufficient and efficient resource, needs to be handled well, but it is God's word. And therefore, in terms of what we do, it's our guide. We have the work of the Spirit working within us, taking the word of God and making it really comprehensible to our minds and then assisting us in applying it. And of course, we pray that the Spirit might really empower us, might guide us, might lead us. So we walk by the Spirit. Then we have practice. Not in terms of piano practicing, but we actually do it. And so we need to identify in practicing, we need to identify what I call platforms of opportunity. In other words, as we want to be visible in our testimony, as we want to be a visible city on a hill, we need to be practicing it. Maybe, and I say this tentatively, maybe before even proclaiming it. And I know that we don't all agree with that, but my own experience has been that, especially the young generation, they're so far removed from where we're coming from very often, and we don't have a credible voice. Who are you to talk to me? And so I wonder sometimes if we need to practice before we proclaim. Certainly we need to do both together, but I just wonder if there's a sense of practice before proclamation. And of course, the fourth thing is proclamation. There is no way in which we can just love people into heaven. You know, by the way in which I ride my bike, they're going to get saved. You know, that's not the way it is. We need to actually... Okay, I wanted to go on to, I've got some kind of fairly substantial bits I want to kind of get into. And so probably there we'll look at, we'll have some more time to interact. So let's come to the second section, again, in this big picture of multiplying, of planting. So we need to be equipping for planting again. In other words, we need to be equipping our churches, our co-leaders, even our own hearts to plant again. And I think part of that has to do with a vision and DNA. We need a very well-defined vision, what we want to do. So Ed Stetzer writes in an article, God's people are to participate in the divine mission to manifest and advance God's kingdom on earth through the means of sharing and showing the gospel of God's kingdom in Jesus Christ. And I think we heard it in one of Philip's sessions that we need to intentionally build in the church planting truth and value within the DNA of our church. It comes from inception. It comes from birth. As we make disciples, part of that making disciples is so that they will see that they are made disciples to make disciples, if you know what I mean. So it mustn't be something that we get into in year three of Christianity, but right from the start. And so we need a vision, and we need to be able to articulate that vision. We need to teach that vision, and then we need to live it out. Secondly, we need to be in a position of raising up leaders. And I'll be going into this in the next session that follows this. And so essentially what we're talking about is in the context of church planting, we need to develop ordinary and healthy rhythms of responsibility for others. In other words, that this is not just me as the pastor or the missionary or the planter or whatever. This needs to be something which we're instilling this value of we exist to church plant and to see disciples made, and the two go together. And so as part of that, we need to really encourage others. And so we need to be in a process in which we're identifying and raising up leaders. And we'll be looking at that a little more. Thirdly, mobilizing churches. Now, in Italy, we have a statement, we have a saying, and the saying is armiamoci e partite, which literally means, come on, let's take up our weapons, and then you go. So the idea is a call to war, and then I'll call you to war, but then you go. Obviously, if we want to see our churches mobilized for church planting, we must take the lead, and we must lead by example. You mustn't just tell others what to do if you're not willing to do it, because you're not credible at that point. And again, quite a bit could be said about that. But I think there are some simple steps that you can identify which will allow people to get an appetite for doing this. And even in a sense, when people, I've seen this in my own experience, when people actually get into it, the initial stage is, what's this all about? I'm scared. What happens if? And then once they get doing it, the Holy Spirit kind of comes in and really calms hearts down. And I found that often people who are shy and withdrawn, they actually get into it and they see the joy of doing it. And so, again, a first step sometime is quite crucial. But let's talk about planning for planting, because, again, this is an issue I think we need to be looking at. And, again, Philip brought this up in a session earlier on. So as you understand the equipping side of things, you need to teach it, you need to define, you need to teach it, and so on. What about the planning? How are we going to actually plan for that to happen? And so this is a big question. When is it the right time to plant again? Now, can we open, any thoughts on that? Let's have a little bit of a mini discussion here. Any thoughts on when is the right time for a church to plant? What do you think? If you think.
There is never a right time.
There's never a right time. So it's always a wrong time, then, you're saying.
No, I'm trying to say that there will never be a perfect time to plant a church.
Okay. So that's one comment. Any other comments? Any other thoughts on that? Never the right time.
Seems like as soon as there are at least one, but preferably more than one person who have it on their hearts, and who, okay, and the church is sensing the Spirit sending them out. So that, I mean, that will at least be the couple times I can think of in Acts. It seems like it was that time.
Is it possible to plant too early? See if it's never the right time. Can it be too early to plant?
Well, isn't that kind of like with a family? I mean, a lot depends on the maturity of the people involved. And okay, I mean, they can be very old, but very immature. And sure, yep, you can conceive a child, but it will not be a healthy way how to raise that child. And that child will have developmental issues because you weren't mature enough to support that child. But at the same time, You know, you had people who were way more mature 50, 100 years ago when they were 18 or 17 or 16 than they are today when 25 or 30. So it doesn't really depend on the maturity of the planting church.
That would be another interesting conversation to get in. You know, what are the markers? This is one of the things that came up in one of the early sessions. What are the markers of maturity in this question? So how do we know? And then can it be used as a bit of an excuse? I mean, I was with a leader from a church which has been around 150 years and no church plants. And, well, we're not ready. We're not mature enough. Well, you know, it can become a bit of a lame excuse. So, but yeah, it's a good. So again, just to kind of reiterate, I think there is this sense of it needs to be the normal culture. So it needs to be the normal culture with our own way of thinking. So we need to be thinking that way. It's almost like the thought of doing it is as important as doing it. I know that's not a fair statement, but there is that sense that it needs to be very primary in our minds, in our hearts. That's what we really want to do. Again, the desires. And so there are a few things that maybe we could say maybe by default, maybe these are universal things. First of all, you need to be intentionally promoting church planting, multiplication. So it's not enough to say, oh, it's a value that I treasure inside my heart, but you actually need to be promoting it. You need to have some available leadership of some kind to actually multiply. Now, again, we could debate whether we plant and then find the leaders or whether we find the leaders and then plant, but at least it's an issue we have to grapple with. You need the necessary resources to accomplish the task. And I'm not saying what resource. I'm not saying some people, they have a, you know, there's a budget standard, and if you don't have that budget, you can't do anything. I'm not even saying that. But I'm saying that certainly you need to see what are the necessary resources to accomplish the plan. You need to launch, if you're doing a church plant, you need to launch that church plant where and when you're able to maintain a degree of continuity. In other words, it's easy to kind of flash in the pan. We'll do this big blitz, and then 2 weeks in, we're kind of, you know, we're nowhere and we're half dead and we haven't got the power, the energy to maintain it. So there needs to be a degree of continuity. And then you need to be planning for multiplication. So again, but just an example from here, city of Palermo. So when we arrived, the two couples, we were working another couple, and immediately when we started, we had a small group which developed, and I think there were 10 of us at that stage, and we divided into two groups the week after. And it wasn't so much the fact that, well, we needed to, but the fact we wanted to, because it was a statement. And so that's something maybe to consider. And again, you need to be asking yourself, again, sometimes I've got questions more than answers, which is probably not very helpful in a webinar of this kind, but the question is it the right time now? And you need to ask yourself that question. If you say yes, well, why? And if you say no, well, why? And you've got to kind of process it. If you feel that you're not in a position where you can plant, are there others you could partner with, other churches, other individuals? And again, you need a clarity of plan. You need to have clear decisional processes if you're going to do that. And then if you really feel it's not the time for some reason, well, can we continue planning and praying for it? In other words, it needs to be something you nurture. You don't put it on the back burner and forget it, because eventually it'll get burnt. And so that's not appropriate. So again, those are a few things relating to the timing. But, and this is, I suppose, where it comes into, we come into more of a discussion now, because in terms of identifying a model, and there are so many variants, which is the best model? So again, depending where you are, urban, rural, post kind of Christian, maybe pre-Christian, post-modernist, no modern, I don't know, whatever. There are all kinds of variants. But as you try and identify a model, then again, forgive it at this stage, maybe a series of questions. So you need to be asking yourself, who are we and where are we coming from? In other words, what's our heritage, our history? I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying you need to ask, you need to engage with that. You need to be looking at what's distinctive about us and what's distinctive about our culture. In terms of the model we prefer. And I'm not saying again that necessarily is the right way to approach it, but it's a question to ask. Is there already anything in place? So are we already building on something existing? And what does that look like? Another question, for this particular context, what might be the most relevant way to reach into that particular community or context? So it can be geographical, it can be social. And again, it's about questions. I've got about 50 questions, but I won't bore you with them. But the idea is ask yourselves questions as you try and identify a model. And when you have identified a model, you need to, of course, explore it carefully. You need to critique it, look at it objectively, try and, you know, see what others are doing and how it's gone. You need to be critical, positively, but also negatively. And then eventually, I guess all of us, we need to embrace one kind of model. But I would suggest that whatever model you embrace, do it lightly. Because what happens is often we come in with our big strategy, our big plans, and that's great. And then 1 month into the church plant, we realize that God's actually presented us a completely different, unexpected scenario. So I came here in Palermo to reach out primarily to university students and the kind of professionals. And the people who are responding are all semi-literate. So all my kind of great, you know, I'm going to do this. Maybe it will happen. But right now, what do? I can't reach you. Sorry, you haven't got 6 degrees. Well, you obviously have to kind of hold your model lightly. Now, again, just working on the basis, and we'll have a bit of discussion in a minute, working on the basis that there's no infallible method. Here are at least three, and I know it's not exhaustive, and I didn't want it to be exhaustive. I wanted just to be a bit of a teaser so you would think it through. But here are a few common models. So a solo pioneer. Now, this is probably the most archaic. This is the guy who goes into the jungle by himself. And, of course, there are advantages. He never ends up having team conflict. Maybe he disagrees with himself a little bit, but if I was that pioneer, I would disagree with myself. But anyway, and of course there's great advantages because you set the pace and whatever, but there are limitations and dangers, and I won't go into that. I'm sure you're aware of them. Second model, a local church planting team. So core team, and probably with X29, this is the one we would like most, or we like most. So a church identifies a group of members and mandates them to go and plant a church. So it becomes a church planting a church in some way. And of course, in that model, the leadership needs to be well-defined. The core needs to be well-defined. The competencies need to be well-defined. It's very strategic. There's a plan and it's good. And in a sense, I think this is the most, when it works, it's the most natural expression of a church planting kind of process. Although having said that, there are challenges as well. So, for example, what's the relationship between the planted church and the mother church? Or, you know, is this a daughter, a satellite, an orphan? You know, what is it? There are all kinds of questions and models that you can kind of play around with there. And then the third, and again, just because I'm trying to contain in terms of time, the third would be a non-local church planting team. So this will happen when a church identifies a particular planting project. Maybe a person has a burden, as John said, you know, you want to do something specific, and it's maybe distant from the church or distant from where the church is. And so maybe there are no resources, maybe a lot of those questions, you know, is it the right time? Church would say, well, we haven't got the ability to do anything. So then maybe you get an agency in the mix. And this brings together church planters or a team of church planters from different backgrounds. And so then you kind of launch out with that. And I know that in mission agencies, this is what often happens. You don't necessarily choose your colleagues, and you don't often choose your team members. And even when you do choose your team members, that's no guarantee that's going to go forward. So this is all very encouraging, but it has to be realistic because this is Europe and because we're totally depraved human beings with sinful and deceptive hearts. So if that happens, that you're part of a team, I really encourage you, you need to ensure that there's clear leadership, there are clear plans, and then that the management elements are in place, and especially accountability and pastoral support. So if you're going to get a couple of people together from different backgrounds, maybe slightly different, you know, theological orientations, again, just be careful that you're thinking ahead of time, how do we confront and how do we plan this thing through? And then just finally, before we have a few comments on that, a couple of words on the issue of timing. So again, when is it right? And again, I can't give too many details, but in thinking it through, here is something I would suggest as possible steps, if you like, in your church planting timeline. So just very quickly, the first I've called the feeler culture. So you know when you put out feelers, is it the right time? Is it the right moment? Is it the right place? And I think, again, I'm really good at doing this. As I move around, and every time I go out, even in the city here or travel around, I'm always always, even when I'm flying, I'm looking down and thinking, wow, I wonder how we could plant a church there. And it's very easy when you're at 36,000 feet to try and think how do you plant a church on the ground, because it's, you're kind of zooming over all of Europe. But even in the local context, you're always putting feet, you know, where are the opportunities? Where are the people who are interested? Where is the need? Where is the, you know, where's the challenge? Where's the, again, it's just the question of putting feelers out. So it's a culture you need to be creating. Secondly, define your target. So as you put out feelers and something comes back, define your target. It might be geographical area or it might be a group of people. I mean, there are other variants, but those would be the two, I suppose, most popular, especially the first, the particular geographical area, I think is the most obvious. Third, assess and plan. In other words, become familiar with the area or the group. Do an Acts chapter 17 type of model, where Paul goes into Athens and the first thing he does, he observes and he looks around and he sees the idols and he identifies then an opportunity. So assess and then plan the best way to reach out. What hooks or links might there be? Are there any evident or obvious locations, people, places? You know, you're kind of doing an assessment of where you're trying to plant. And then fourthly, an integral approach. Maybe because I've been around a bit, I'm a bit skeptical again of we're going to put all our chips on one particular model and so on. Whereas if you do, I think, an integrated approach or an integral approach, so it's you're not doing it just organically, but you're not just doing it with a cathedral, but you're actually willing to combine elements and say, well, you know, can we do some organic, some in the home, some with individuals, some in small groups? You know, again, what are these central values? Is there place for events? How quickly, how soon, what kind of events? But if everything's in an event, you spend, you know, 3 months preparing for an event, maybe that's not the best use of resources and time, because you're not engaging with people and you're not organic enough. So then at the event, just random people turn up. Instead, if you've already engaged organically and on a one-to-one level, then possibly at the events, it's just a kind of it's coming together of friends. So that's what I'm just trying to say, better to use maybe an integral approach. And then finally, in this timeline, as you're going along, so you're beginning to move forward, always review it critically. Always question, what are the dangers? What are the weaknesses? What are the possibilities, even positively? So as you're engaging in steps towards multiplications, always critically assess if this is the most appropriate way forward. Okay, we're gonna move on. That I think is helpful. And again, we could talk a lot about equipping a church like that. And again, we could talk about equipping young Christians, you know, just come to faith, and how do we equip them for church? Because a lot of fear and a lot of I don't know enough. But then, in a sense, you know, how much do you need to know? I was blind and now I see. I always quote that as a prime example. But let's move into a kind of the final section. So in this final section, so again, I was thinking of how do we plant? How do we multiply? So that's a bit of the theory, you know, the vision for it, you know, the planning for it, you know, the timing, the models. Again, we haven't got too much into it, but hopefully you've got the idea. You need to be asking questions and you need to be exploring and examining. And then once you've identified something, you need to kind of go for it. So now let's try and do something a little more practical. So I want to suggest that you draw thoughts together from even the past sessions. So you've been in other sessions, you know, like correct doctrine and a healthy church and so on. And think through what you could be doing now to further church multiplication. So it's really picking up the conversation we've just had. But how could you actually promote or further church multiplication? And how could you personally engage in church multiplication? You know, you personally, or even better, your church. So what would it take, or how could you help progress or facilitate the moving forward of your church into church planting? So maybe you already have plans in place for that to happen within your church or your setting. So now you can think through how something which has maybe come up in these sessions or even today could actually move you a step further ahead. So I wanted it to be an attempt to encourage you to take a step further, because if you come to a session like this about church planting, I would be kind of rather disappointed if we all went away knowing more about it but doing less about it. So there is that sense in which, and now, okay, let's take it and move forward. So I'm just going to suggest that we do three things. One is what I've called a self-check. So as you look at yourself and your church, describe yourself, a little bit about yourself, your experience in your church. Is there anything that you could be doing better or you should be doing better in the process of planning for church planting? Is there something, an opportunity out there that you could really kind of capitalize on? And even in that picture, are there any significant roadblocks? So are there things that really you say, okay, this is the situation I'm in, here's a big roadblock. You need to identify that. Secondly, an assessment. So as Acts 29, we're kind of big on assessment of church planters. So if anybody is looking for an assessment to be a church planter, we're the go-to organization. I just wanted to make that clear. It was very spontaneous and off the cuff, but it's true. But anyhow, apart from that, that was a publicity plug. But in terms of assessing the plans, so what are your hopes? What are your plans? What's your vision? What's your burden? So assess it. Do you have a clearly defined strategy, or is it just vague? What resources have you already got in place? Have you got, you know, people? Have you got, I don't know, ideas? Have you got a very well-defined field? Again, I don't like that concept, but you understand what I'm saying, I hope. Have you got a well-defined social group you're trying to reach out? In other words, are there resources already in place to make the plan actually move forward? And again, in the assessment of it, so you're talking about a little bit about yourself and your church, describe yourself and your church, and then are there any significant roadblocks even in that? So as you assess, what's stopping you from taking the next step? That's the thing we love to ask. What's the next step? And so why aren't you taking the next step? What is it that's kind of holding you back? And then finally, and this would be the third step in the exercise, what's the next step? So the action, what's your action plan? What steps should you be taking? What steps could you be taking to implement and develop the plan? And what are the risks? And again, I'm hoping, I know this is not all in writing, but at least it's kind of shaping your discussion. And then what elements of encouragement or confirmation are there that could be encouraging you in that direction? Now, so I thought I'd put this picture up because I rather liked it. So I'm wondering what you saw first. And I look at it, I carry on looking at it, and I see it depends. It's the brain is weird, isn't it? Depends how you look at it. So I don't know if you saw the front of the profile. If I was a psychoanalyst or whatever, then I'd tell you because of what you saw who you are. But but I won't do that because I'm not. But again, it has to do a lot with perspective. It's true, it's in the blood, but it also has a lot to do with perspective. And so I think as time goes by, I think there's that sense of either despondency or fear or we can't do it or whatever. And so are we focusing more on the roadblocks and the obstacles, or are we focusing more on the opportunity and the challenge before us? In other words, you know, it has a lot to do with really with the way we see things. And so it's interesting because in 2019 in the USA, research concluded that 1/3 of churches were involved in some way in church planting, which is a very, I think, good figure. But then just over 10% said they were directly involved in a new church. So that's in the US, 10% of churches in some way involved in church planting. Again, is that positive? Yes, 10%. Is that, if you look at it from the 90% who doesn't, the churches were not involved in church planting in a direct way, that's obviously quite worrying. So the blood's there, but something's stopping it. So again, quoting Ed Stetzer, kingdom-minded leaders stop focusing on what is hard or risky, move beyond the comfort of addition within their own building and risk. Jesus wants risk takers. He calls for courage. He expects us to be like him. So may each one of us in our own ministry and spheres of influence be increasingly ambitious and effective in prayerfully working together for work for church multiplication. Okay. So this is the final session in the steps section. So I guess you have followed the other sessions in the steps track, if you like. And what we've been trying to do is to identify key strategic steps so that we can become strong and healthy churches or church plants. And we finished our conversation today, and we want to consider another important area and an important tool in progressing a church plant, or even a church for that matter, from infancy to maturity. And so whatever context you're in, whether it's a church plant or a church, the importance of leadership is obvious, as you can tell from the picture. And our anchor verse for this particular session is Ephesians chapter 4, verse 16. where it says, from whom the whole body joined and held together by every joint with which it is equipped, when each part is working properly, and this is the section, makes the body grow so that it builds itself up. And so the idea is the body contributing to the growth of the body. And so I would say the need for leaders to equip the body to do that is obviously essential. So I'm going to go straight into it. And we're going to begin by talking about biblical leadership. Now, in his book, From Good to Great by Jim Collins, he suggested that the key was having the right people on the bus. So he says, if you're in a company or an organization or whatever, as long as you've got the right people on the bus, you can take the bus anywhere you want. So it's not so much where you're going, but it's who's on the bus. And if you're running a business, I guess that makes sense. Even if you're trying to organize a core team or a ministry team, that makes sense as well. But if you run your church, like Jim Collins suggests, then you'd probably have nobody much left on the bus, at least if your church is anything like the ones I've been in. So I just say that because you might get some good insights and suggestions from secular thinking and corporate language, but there are also some inherent dangers in modeling our understanding of leadership around secular models. And so these are some of the kind of the quotes that come from a variety of secular thinkers and people who suggested that these could be some indicators of what leadership is. But when we come to spiritual leadership, what are we talking about? And this is Dr. Mark Dever. And so this is, I feel, a healthy definition. It's not perfect, and I'll tell you why I don't think it's perfect. Because you're talking about spiritual leadership, therefore, this is one way of looking at it. If you're talking about church leadership, which is a form of spiritual leadership, in his book, The Shepherd Leader, Timothy Whitmer says, the fundamental responsibility of church leaders is to shepherd God's flock. And then later he says, shepherding is at the very heart of the biblical picture of leadership. And then he adds, unfortunately, this emphasis is missing in many churches. So church leadership, again, is quite crucial. And I think in a lot of these definitions, the limitations are that you presume a particular context. So you presume a body of Christian community, a church. And that's in a church planning situation, that's not always obvious. So obviously, again, you have to take different definitions and you have to make a complete as you can idea. And then certain things are more applicable to certain contexts than others. So again, I'm thinking what makes a good leader in a church planting situation where you've got some context or you've got some people who are not even Christians and yet they belong to the community without having believed yet. And when I say belonged, I don't mean they belong to God's family. I mean, they're attending a community, they're part of a community, and you're leading them. And so again, what are the implications of that? But when it comes to, obviously, to biblical leadership, I'm going to try and go pretty quickly with this. I just wanted to help you by thinking that, again, in terms of where we look for definitions, there are three good places to look. The first is God, and that's, again, I think fairly obvious, but sometimes it goes beyond this. In other words, when you think of the way God leads, how does he deal with his enemies? What about the way in which he communicates? What about the character which emerges when he's dealing with a people that are not perfect? And again, you can learn a lot from leadership by looking at God. So I think that's a supreme source of leadership training. And then again, another area, and again, we could expand these and flesh them out, but for a matter of time, we can't. Again, if you look at the role of the man in the family, and I just want to hone in on that. I'm not saying that's all the family. I'm just saying let's hone in on the role of the man in the family. We as X29, we believe that is a very, very crucial element, this whole complementarian, egalitarian, but that's not the focus of this. But in terms of the role of a man, so for example, in what way is a husband called to lead? And if you read Ephesians 5:23, it's about loving, caring, sacrificial. It's very intentional, and you get a lot of good examples. So when you're thinking of leading, think how a husband has to lead. That influences and impacts the way you think of leadership. What about fathering? Again, Ephesians chapter 6, where it talks about not provoking your children to anger, but bringing them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And it's interesting that Paul uses the same term, the father. He says, talking about the Corinthians, I'm a father to you. And so there's a lot that we can learn from some of these metaphors and images which are presented in scripture. The third one I'm thinking about is obviously leadership in terms of the church. So what stands out is that leaders lead, and that can sound very obvious, but sometimes it's not. A leader is called to lead. And it's interesting that depending on where you stand, of course, on church governance and church polity, but we have two offices or two major functions and roles in the New Testament ecclesiology. One is the role of elders, and I would say another defining names which define better the role of elders. And essentially, the elders are to rule. Essentially, the elders are to care or watch over the flock. So they're to lead, they're to teach, they're to pray. There's an element of presidency in their role. And again, there's a lot we can learn from the role of an elder. And then the second form of leadership, if you like, is the role of deacons or the office of deacons. And they are called to serve. And again, even the way in which they are described as people of character helps us to understand a little bit about biblical leadership. And I think I personally agree with Grudem, not that that's important, but I just say it just like that, who suggests that all other specific ministries, so let's talk about other ministries which are not exactly defined as I'm an elder and I'm a deacon, but he suggests that they could probably be put in the category of either elder or deacon. And I like the simplicity of that model. And I think it helps us kind of hone in on what a leader actually is. So whatever you're doing, I think you can either be put in a deaconate or an elderate. I know that elderate doesn't exist, but we're inventing words. Okay, let's move on then, because for a matter of time, we need to kind of really plow on. So in terms of raising up leaders, because this is really the focus, we're talking about leaders, but we're talking specifically about raising them up. And you remember in the first session I did, maybe you don't remember, but anyway, I did it. We spoke about healthy churches, and obviously healthy churches are churches with leaders. And so we went into it a little bit. Yesterday was about doctrine. We sort of mentioned a bit about doctrine, and that was very relevant as well to the importance of who, or what leaders actually are called to do. They're called to teach good doctrine or to live according to good doctrine. But in terms of raising up leaders, so I'm thinking of leaders emerging. And again, in all walks of life, it's important to have a leader. But be careful not to buy in too much to the secular mindset in terms of what makes a good leader. Because in our context, the best way to define a spiritual leader is the way up is down, as we well know, some of us. We don't become the famous people. We become maybe the anonymous people, but that doesn't mean that we're not good leaders. And it's just that's just the way. Whereas in the world, the corporate and secular world will define your good leader by, you know, how effective you are in doing your job or how loud you are. Or again, we could talk about that endlessly. But in our context, a godly Christ-like attitude and practice is what we're aspiring to find as we raise up leaders. We're looking for godly men. We're looking for godly people that we're going to raise up as leaders. So what we're exactly focusing on here, we're asking how can we seek to identify, to nurture, and then release leaders to lead churches? And of course, it's important because of the statement up there. If we want to kind of go anywhere in church planting or church growth or church maturing, the issue of one of the key issues is the leader. So I would say that in some cases, leaders emerge naturally. In other words, to us it's obvious. Let's say to us it's obvious. But behind that, to us it's obvious, and the leaders emerge naturally. There's a whole mindset there. There's a whole idea that we have, that I have, that you have, of what we expect from a good leader. And again, sometimes that depends on who I am, what my culture is, and where I'm coming from, maybe even what country I'm coming from. And so there are a lot of variants in that. But what are we looking for, especially in the area of raising up leaders and church planting? And then once they're identified, how do you shape them? How do you train them so that they become good leaders? In other cases, leaders need to be literally raised. So you have to kind of, you have to be a bit of a talent scout. You know, you go and see a six-year-old playing football or soccer, depending on what language you speak, and you see enough in that six-year-old to raise him up, because you see enough there that you think there's something there. There's that kind of talent scout. I think that's what we need to be honing in on. Where you detect potential, then you need to work with it and develop it, nurture it, and make it grow. So here's some, I think, very important questions. So how do you raise up leaders? So the first thing is obvious. God must be the one who calls. in the Old Testament, men of God were raised up and called directly by God. But in a sense, the call of God on your life, that concept, is essential. It makes all the difference, especially in the hard days. If you're not called, if you're not raised up by God to accomplish a task, if you're not equipped by the Spirit, if you're not led by the Spirit, then when it's a hard day, you're going to kind of just give up and go away. So it must be, you must be called to God. Second, leaders must call other lead, must call others to lead. So two examples, Moses and Joshua, and then Paul and Timothy. Those are just two examples. But there is a sense in which as a leader, part of my remit as a leader is to call others to lead. It's not just to say, okay, until I'm, you know, 107, I'm going to lead and there's going to be leaders, no other leaders with me. Within a church, often I think it's the current leaders who should be calling other leaders. And again, I don't want to get caught up in the whole church polity, governance, congregationalism, episcopate, you know, all that kind of stuff, because that's not the focus of this session. But the idea is that leaders must be looking out for other prospective leaders and raising them up. And then again, that statement again, leaders emerge naturally. So who are the people the others follow and listen to in your congregation, in the context that you have around you? Who stands out in any given situation? As you observe them, who are the ones that you say, yes, there's something there, or not, there's something, there's actually a gifting or a ministry or a natural ability. And then they need to be maybe invited sometimes to step up. And I've added the fourth, leaders may come forward because it's not an obvious thing. So again, take Timothy as an example. Timothy didn't stand up to this kind of automatically to the plate. He was quite timid and withdrawing, and he had to be encouraged. So you could quote David, you know, David came forth and he was a kind of a natural who came forward. But not all are like that. Some, you know, like Moses is like, whoa, me, never. You know, so we have to be careful not to make too much of that. But again, the raising up of leaders, God calls them, but then we need to be engaging with actually who they are. Now, as we try and raise them up, how do we actually do it? So again, what are we looking for? Those are the characteristics. But in terms of how do we do it? And again, very simple things, but hopefully things which will be helpful in your mental process. So the first thing is you need to be prayerfully observing and acting. You need to act reactively and act proactively. Now, let me explain a little bit what I'm trying to mean. First of all, we do need to do this prayerfully because our tendency often, I'm not saying for everybody, but often our tendency is we get sidetracked by certain elements which we feel are more important. So an ability, for example, to speak, or a big personality to lead, you know, he's a good leader, or somebody who's successful in secular life, he's a director of a company, for example. And often what we see is, you know, just the appearance, but if we're not doing it prayerfully, we're going to forget the importance of the heart and the mind. Again, that 90%, according to some who've suggested that figure, that 90% of the leadership which needs to be defined by character and not by competence. And again, maybe 90 is exaggerated, but that's what somebody suggests. So we need to be asking for wisdom from on high as we move ahead in raising up leaders. Secondly, we need to observe. And I think this is very important within our churches, within our context, with other Christians, we need to observe their behavior, their actions, and I would suggest especially their reactions. Because again, it's a telling tale of their character, where their heart is. So is there somebody, and this is a question I want to ask, is there somebody that you're watching and have a growing feeling or conviction that this could be a leader to raise up? It might be a teenager. I'd even say it could be a child. That you get that sense of, wow, there's somebody, there's something that really seems to be a potential for, there's something in that person, a potential leader. So two things, act reactively. So some emerging leaders will come forward, hi, I want to be a leader. Or it's just obvious, you know, they're big, they're pretty, in a good sense, loud or whatever. And so, you know, as people come or as people emerge naturally, react to that. Be careful. Screen and assess, or we say vet. You need to be careful. What are you dealing with? You might be dealing with a person who's completely full of himself and maybe who's got a godless character. So you need to be very careful. In Italy, we have a famous comedian called Totò. And in one of his very famous movies, he votes for himself. He stands in front of an open window and he says, vote for me, vote for me, vote for me. When that happens in a church, maybe there are a few dangers with that kind of leader. You don't necessarily want to go down that way. But so act reactively, but then act proactively as well. As you see promising seeds of potential leadership, consider coming alongside the person, maybe investing time and energy and helping him or her develop their potential. Now you see that here I'm going kind of quite in a deliberate detail, because these are the big issues that in church planting you face. As you have a small congregation and you're beginning to say, are there any people there who could maybe be helping us? As you're a church and you're thinking, we want to plant another church, where are the leaders? So these are very, very crucial tools to be able to progress in church life. So what kind of leaders are we praying for? So who are the leaders we're trying to raise up? So again, very simple things to begin with, at least. Character. So again, the character of the person needs to emerge. And it's interesting that somebody wrote, the characteristics of eldership taught by Paul in 1 Timothy 3 reflect an ordinary street-level godliness which is revealed in the context of everyday life. In other words, when you look at the character of the elders, I mean the preachers, the teachers, the shepherds, the prophets, you know, when you look at the character, you're not looking at anything extraordinary in terms of character. It should be pretty normal. So anyhow, that's an interesting quote. So the backdrop of Christian leadership must be Christian character. And so there are seven characteristics that I want to suggest. And I want to say that I didn't take these from a book and I didn't download them off internet. So just in case you're wondering. Now, that doesn't mean they're good. I'm just saying this is not from anything else. So godly character. So the fruit of the Spirit. Look at the family. Look at the wife. Talk with the wife. You know, is what we're seeing, is that the way it is? What about the reputation? So again, godly character. Secondly, spiritual gifting. And this may or may not coincide with their natural ability. A professional jazz pianist might not necessarily be using it as a ministry. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. That's not a kind of a given. There needs to be spiritual gifting. And again, that's difficult to put your finger on, but I wanted to put up there. Third, who are humble and teachable. And that's a hard one, isn't it, in leadership. As you're raising up, you want strong leaders, but leaders who are committed to servanthood and who have a sober judgment of themselves. As they look at themselves, they don't think, man, God has waited so long for me to arrive on the scene, because that's sometimes the way it seems. And then fourth, who are faithful. And again, that goes straight into 1 Timothy 2:2. Faithful to God, faithful to his truth, his doctrine, and faithful in all that they do. They're dependable in a sense. Fifth, who can handle responsibility and pressure. Again, you're wanting to raise up leaders who are able to cope, able to react in a gospel way in times of criticism and pressure and when everything is complicated. Sixth, the identity is not in being a leader. Because that is such a dangerous one. You know, my whole identity revolves around the fact that I'm an elder. And then you take my eldership away after 3 years and I die because I am an elder. I am a pastor. I am a leader. I'm a church planter. So again, you've got to be careful that you're not producing a series of leaders who then will die once they stop being leaders because they're called less than a leader. And then seventh, we're able to work in a team, which is the normal picture of biblical leadership. I'd say the normal picture of biblical leadership is within a context, a framework of working with others. Now, there can be different roles, and I agree with that, but at the same time, you've got to learn to work with others. If you don't know how to work with others, it's possible that you're not going to be a good leader. Well, no, it's actually very probable you're not going to be a good leader. So let's go to the second area. So again, who? They've got to have character, they've got to have competencies. And Greg Allison in the book Sojourners and Strangers, which is the doctrine of the church, he says, elders are entrusted with certain responsibilities, teaching, leading, praying, and shepherding. And then when he talks of deacons, he says, at the heart of the diaconate is the simple idea of service. The diaconate is devoted to serving in all other areas of the church. So I wanted to put that in as well, because I think the two offices are important and they act as containers and categories, if you like, for leadership. So in leaders, we're essentially looking for a gifting. I've said this before, but again, specifically, which enables them to function significantly in a particular area of ministry. So when does a normal sharing of the word become a leader teaching the word. You understand the kind of the issue. It doesn't mean that nobody can never kind of share in a Bible study, but when is it that that is so significant that that is a leader, that is a teacher, that is a shepherd, that is a prophet? That it, again, it's that question. Competencies, who in the case of elders can teach. That is the one distinguishing factor in the role of an elder by contrast with everybody else. And again, ecclesiology is quite debatable, but that is the way at least we see it. And then thirdly, who in the case of deacons can serve. Again, pretty obvious. If you've got a deacon and he's not serving and he can't serve and he doesn't know how to serve, good possibility he shouldn't be a deacon. And then fourthly, who function in their office, in their role, in the light of the gospel. And who are not going to be led by some guru of leadership and so on, but they're just going to actually function in the light of the gospel. And finally, what? Finally, what? So, in a sense, how do you raise up leaders? What do you do now? So let's assume you know what you're looking for, you've kind of defined, you've got people of character, people of competencies. Now what do you do? What do you do to actually raise them up? So there's an interesting word in 1 Timothy 3:10, and it's that word proven or tested. And it says that essentially the deacons, they need to be proven. They need to be tested. It says, and let them also be tested. So when it says also, it means them and the elders as well. So, and then it says, then let them serve as deacons if they prove themselves blameless. And it doesn't describe what we're actually looking at, what kind of process. In other words, how does it work? Does it last a year? Is it a week? Is it overseen by who? In other words, it's not defined, but the principle is there. So that's what we're looking at. Advanced church planting. We need to raise up leaders. In raising them up, we need to give them a time in which they are proven or tested. And then assessed. I think that's, again, because of our Acts 29 connection, that's really, really important. So Alexander Strauch, in his book, Biblical Eldership, he devotes a whole chapter to protecting, disciplining and assessing the elders. So he underlines, prevention is the best cure, avoid hasty appointments. And he quotes another author, Stan Guthrie, who's a famous writer of commentaries. He says, undue haste in Christian appointments has not infrequently led to unworthy men bringing havoc to the cause of Christ. And then Strauch goes on to say, time and testing are still the best procedures to guide, not guida, it's Italian. To guide in leadership appointment. So again, you're before this issue of we need to assess: is it too early? Are we waiting too long? It's not easy. It's not an easy concept. That's why you have to say principles, values, big picture stuff, and then you apply them to a specific case. So godly leadership is certainly vital for the well-being of the church, and so church planters should actually, as soon as is possible and as soon as is feasible and wise, they should be appointing elders. And I think just to finally kind of close it down, I think there is a sense in which you can do it too quickly, but you can also do it too late. And so exactly when the right time is, it's not scientific, but we need to be asking the question, is this the right person? Is this the right time? And is this the right place? Now, we haven't got time to go into a series of, what about releasing leaders? So again, we've identified them, we've found character competencies, and we're proving them. So how do you actually release them? So again, three simple words, train. Henry Ford said, anyone who stops learning is old, whether at 20 or 80. Anyone who keeps learning stays young. In fact, that's me, forever young, because I'm always learning, because I don't know. So there's a sense in which you need to be constantly training your leaders, but also as a leader, you need to be constantly training. Because as you raise up a leader, he might be a good leader potentially, but very raw. So you need to be coming along and mentoring and coaching or whatever word you prefer to use. Don't take anything for granted and don't release. Go and plant a church. Maybe it's too early. So you need to train. And I had a conversation yesterday with somebody. He said, I planted a church and it was too early. If I'd known, I would have said, no, it's not the time. And then 5 years into it, it wasn't the right time. And the training side of things was maybe lacking. Secondly, send. So again, as you identify leaders, you need to be sending them out. And Acts 13 is the model for that. And finally, support. Support your leaders. Sometimes you raise up a leader and you send him out and he goes into another church or another church plant. You need to continue supporting. And again, I would encourage you to think through, what does a coaching culture look like? A culture of coaching. Now, again, be very careful. This is not micromanagement. You don't know how to do it. I'm far more experienced. Let me do it. No. The leader needs to get his own experience. You're not micromanaging, but you're walking alongside. In my language, you're mentoring him. You're kind of supporting him. You're coaching him. Again, whatever term you prefer to use. Now, the final thing I wanted to suggest to you is very quickly this. It's a proposal, and you haven't got time to look at it in a thorough way. You'll only have probably around 10 minutes to do this. But my aim is to get you thinking a little bit and to be clear and intentional in the process of raising up and training leaders. So a little bit of brainstorming, and this is my brainstorming. I brainstormed with myself, which is not really clever, but anyhow, I did it. So I'm trying to think, let's try and develop a template or a matrix. I love this concept of developing templates so that you can, in a sense, rather than going look at the detail, you're looking at a potential leader and then you say, oh, he's a good guy. And then you put on this development matrix. So here's a suggestion. You identify the potential leader. You're asking, does this person give evidence of godly leadership qualities? So you identify one. Then you assess character, competency, strengths, weaknesses. Then you equip theology, gospel, role definition, the office or the ministry that the person is going to cover. What about crisis management plans? In other words, you try and clarify. This is what, you know, we're equipping you to do this, to go and church plant, to go and pastor a church, to go and teach the youth. You were equipping you. Then test that word, proven, test. So again, work out how long it's going to last for, how it's going to work. What are the metrics? What are you looking for? I really like the way you did it. Or is there something a little more scientific? What about pastoral support? What about coaching? What about feedback? What about others talking? What about reassessing at the end of a time? I know I'm going quickly, but I wanted to because it's a lot put in to help you think through and develop your own matrix. And then fifth, function. So again, putting into a role, mandated and then put into role, put into office, and then supported, recognized by the elders, by the congregation, by a ministry of any sort, with a clear job description, with a clear sense of management. In other words, he's not left on his own out there, but he's got a supportive network, a family of churches. Again, I'm plugging Acts 29 here, but anyhow, that's the way it goes. But again, you've got this kind of group alongside. You're not there on your own. So you've got support. And then finally, again, in this context of as you function, you're supported specifically. And I'd say by somebody who actually you're accountable to, somebody who inputs you. And I think it's obviously easy to say, but it's difficult to do, especially for those of us who've been in ministry a long time. Who will be accountable to? Well, our wives most of the time. Maybe that's not always the best. Leadership. Now, there were questions that were actually going on while I was talking, and we don't have the time material to go into it. But it had to do with the roles of apostles, evangelists, prophets, teachers, and shepherds. Interestingly enough, there was no controversy over teachers and shepherds, but a little questioning about Paul and elders and apostles and so on. So I haven't got the time to kind of go into it, but you might like to kind of be challenged by this book. And again, I'm not saying I'm promoting it all. I'm just saying it's an interesting book to look at. And one of the Alan Hirsch in this, who's a forward thinker to say the least, he suggests that the five roles, apostle, prophet, evangelist, shepherd, and teacher, again, in the Ephesians passage, are essential to understand leadership today. And not just leadership, but he uses it as a hermeneutic to kind of understand scripture in general. But it's interesting, this is the way he kind of, and I'm sure you can see this, this is the way he kind of says how it is today in our church. In other words, we don't worry too much about apostle because of the fact that, rightly so, the apostles were witnesses of Jesus. So strictly speaking, we have no apostles. Prophets, again, controversy, we're not sure, so it's a minor thing. Evangelists, we're not too sure how to kind of, usually they're outside the church and they're mavericks. and then you've got the big S, the shepherds, that's what we are. And then the teachers, maybe a little in certain contexts, but not in others. So it's interesting, he says, and the size of the letter gives the importance of the role. I find that very challenging. And I think just to kind of provoke you a little bit, I think apostle, in the strict sense, no, but apostolic, yes. And so because of the fact that apostle is somebody who's sent, I think we need to re-examine some of that issue of apostolic. And so an apostolic role, an apostolic ministry, almost like an adjective, you know, kind of describing an apostolic, you know, whatever, event or something. And same thing for prophet. Prophet, it kind of, the word immediately conjures up, let's think about the future. That wasn't the prophet even of the Old Testament necessarily. So again, what about prophetic rather than just prophet? Apostolic rather than apostle. So that's just something to give you food to think about, or to confuse the issue even more, or to show you how confused I am, or whatever. Whatever way you want to look at that. It's all good fun. Okay, so thanks so much. I'm just going to finish off by one little thought. Interesting picture, and I found it very significant. And again, the context is leaders, and therefore I hope it's pretty obvious what I'm trying to say. When you look into the mirror, what do you see? Do you see yourself, or do you see who you would like to be? So the last kind of leaders we actually need are those who are full of themselves, who are convinced to be lions, whereas little pussycats. Many leaders highly overrate themselves, and we don't need to be raising up even more. If you listen to some presidents, and I won't quote who I'm thinking about in particular, you might find an excessive conviction of the greatness of self. But as I look in the mirror, what do I see? Do I see a lion, or do I see really who I am? A good spiritual leader looks not to himself, but actually looks in the mirror and sees the Lion of Judah. And so it says in Hebrews 12, let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith. So I just want to encourage you, whatever leadership role you're in, as you look in the mirror, always look and see Jesus there.